Chapter 18. Yes, they would be waiting for her. She suspected it would be John Mackey, Jim's father, accompanied by the brothers and perhaps another associate or two. She didn't think the Mackeys would want to get their hands dirty taking out their anger on a woman, though there was that one big thug in the litter, the man who was bursting out of his Savile Row suit, as if rationing had passed him by. If she didn't go back to the house, they would, of course, leave, though someone would stay, the man with the boots, and he would remain until she arrived home, at which point he would detain her and it might well become brutal. The others would return. They would do whatever it was they had planned, her payback for getting involved in their private Mackey business. Perhaps they had a point. But now, lingering by the fence, she knew she had time. Time to think, to reflect, and in that moment she knew she had to stare memories in the face again. Not because they were deep inside, because they weren't. They jostled her every single day, lingering at the edge of everything she did, even on the good days. They were the memories that inspired her to act when she first saw Rose weeping, gripping her child while her husband was being beaten inside their home, the place where they should have been safe. Home is where everyone deserves to be safe. Eleanor clambered over the gate that led to a path through woodland at the edge of Denbury Forest, and continued until she reached a clearing. There she sat on the ground, her back against the trunk of an ancient tree. Even if someone passed, they would not know she was there. Eleanor was always disguised. She had been trained to wear spring colours in spring, summer colours for warm, sunny days, and she could walk through an autumn or winter forest and no one would see her move. She closed her eyes as sun filtered through the canopy overhead, and as if baring her chest for a blade to enter, she drew back the veil that kept 1944 at bay. The doctor at the hospital in Oxford inspected the head wound, peering at her scalp and touching the flesh here and there with a disinfected swab while checking the stitches. I could have used his scalpel, thought Eleanor, as she stared at an array of instruments laid out on a tray. She flinched, feeling her skin move and the odd sharp pain. I wouldn't have made such a mess of things if I'd found one of those. Anyone would have been the perfect tool.
Nasty fall, Captain White, said the doctor, placing the swab in a bowl and washing his hands at the sink before reaching for a clipboard with her hospital record. His name was Dr. Daniel Wright. She knew the nurses giggled about his name. She had heard speculation about how Dr. Wright might become some lucky girl's Mr. Wright. Now, tell me, what exactly did you hit your head on? I see you've been inoculated for tetanus. Wright looked up at her over the clipboard. That's a godsend.
I'm not sure, but I think it was a sort of metal part of a barrow, the rim around a wheel or the hub. And I didn't fall. I was pushed down.
Yes, I see. Major Warren reported that incoming fire from the enemy led you to take cover, which was when you fell.
Did he tell you about the little girl?
The doctor flicked through a couple of pages. No? No, not seeing anything about a girl here.
He looked up at her again. Eleanor nodded, tears forming at the corners of her eyes.
Wright placed a hand on her arm, just above the thick white bandage around her left wrist. Captain, Eleanor, you really can't say anything to me. The fact that you were on the hospital ship at all has been treated with the utmost secrecy. I don't know any more than that, and I do not want to know.
Eleanor nodded. What happened to Major Warren?
Again, I don't know. I'm only a lowly doctor who will make a decision regarding your transfer.
I don't need to go to a convalescent home.
Captain White, I will agree that beyond the matter of healing from a very bad concussion, you will likely not require any occupational or neurological therapies. However, there is the other issue.
What other issue?
The doctor pulled up a chair and sat down so he was closer to Eleanor. She wondered if he was old enough to be a doctor. He seemed so young. Wright was no more than a boy. Perhaps he was a student or another sort of medic. He was in the army. She could see the uniform underneath the white coat, and his hair seemed to have been cut by a military barber. His round spectacles and pallor gave him the appearance of one who had never quite shrugged off a layer of schoolroom chalk dust. "What other issue?" Eleanor repeated.
"Captain White, you tried to kill yourself. You found a bottle in a cupboard on the ship. You smashed the top against the metal sink and you tried to slit your wrist."
He turned his head to see if anyone passing might hear. "I am sure you are very good at what you do, and I am doubly sure that if you wanted to use a broken bottle against an enemy, he would be dead. But you are not dead, and that tells me something."
"And what might that be?" asked Eleanor.
"It tells me that whatever happened to you, whatever ails you, at the end of the day, you really do want to live."
"No, I don't."
"I believe otherwise."
He smiled and took her hand. "When I was a student, we had a professor who was a very odd sort, always doling out stories from his vast medical experience. Here's what he told us one day. Just remember that as the doctor, you are really only there to distract the patient while time and nature do the work of healing. So, Captain Eleanor, allow time and nature to heal you. Give yourself another stab at life. Oh, dear, sorry about the pun." He smiled, pushing back the chair as he came to his feet and picked up the clipboard.
"Right, I'll get the nurse to come in and bathe that wound and dress it again."
"What about the convalescence?"
"I'm told it's to be a rather nice requisitioned stately home near the coast somewhere. Not one I know, but when I tell them you're ready to leave, your transportation will be arranged. I understand a motor car will come for you."
Eleanor shook her head.
"I'm sure you'll be well cared for, Captain White," said the doctor. "I'll have a look at the wound again tomorrow."
Yes, it was all smoke and mirrors. Eleanor stared up into shafts of sunlight beaming to the ground. Smoke and mirrors. She had known, as the kind doctor with schoolboy spectacles described the plan for her convalescence, that she would indeed be looked after. She would be fed and examined, and then she would be debriefed, time and again, required to repeat what had happened, an inquisition planned to reveal what she knew and whether she could be trusted. Above all, though, she understood it would be an assessment of her mental health, her ability to keep secrets, and whether what she had seen and done would render her a liability. Later, as a nurse bathed the wound across the side of her head, she did her best to smile, to feign light-heartedness of character. She would take a leaf out of her dear Cecily's book.
"The trouble with you, Ceci,"
their mother had once observed, following one of Cecily's outbursts, "is that you've always been a bit of a Sarah Bernhardt. You should have gone on the stage." Convalescence would become Eleanor's stage. The curtains would draw back, the interrogators would filter in from left and right, and she would impress them with her turn of phrase, her recall and her record of accomplishment in the guise of Mariana, a woman who sold lipsticks, powder and rouge door to door. This little episode with a broken bottle? Goodness, that was quite the whack she had sustained when she fell, wasn't it? And how did she fall? It must have been the shock of it all, the unexpected German attack, the child running in the street, and her attempt to save lives by aiming at the sniper in the tower. Yes, she would fool them all. And one day at some point in the future, there would be a next time, and she would be sure to end the pain, because when the next time came, she would find the perfect tool. Well, that had been the plan.
"Time to face the music," said Eleanor.
She came to her feet, brushed fallen leaves from her coat, and began to walk toward her house, that generous gift of a grace and favour home for service to king and country, along with a medal. As if she needed another piece of metal on a ribbon. She took a deep breath before slipping her key into the lock and called out when the door was only 2 inches open. Hello, Mr. Mackey. Sorry to keep you waiting. Just let me take my shoes off and I'll join you.
She heard movement behind the door, a pistol readied.
Look, I don't have a weapon, but I really would have appreciated it if you'd seen that little sign outside the door. You know, the one requesting callers to please remove your shoes.
Jim's brother, the one with thinning hair, an ill-fitting suit, and a Luger in his hand, pushed her toward the drawing room where the man she assumed was John Mackey waited, seated in the Queen Anne armchair alongside the Inglenook fireplace. Two younger men sat opposite him. One she recognized first because she had held a gun to his neck. He was cut from the same cloth as his father, with features marking him as a son of the Mackey family. The other startled her. She knew who he was, but tried not to show panic as she struggled to make the connection. John Mackey wore a deep navy blue suit, a flourish of pale aqua silk at the chest pocket, an exact match for a tie embellished with a pin in the shape of a small gold riding whip. His oiled, jet-black hair was greying at the temples. He was relaxed, his elbows resting on the arms of the chair, his hands together, manicured fingers steepled.
Miss Eleanor White, isn't it? By the way, do you think you'll ever go back to DeWitt?
Eleanor shrugged. I might. It depends upon what the future might hold, and where I might find myself.
Indeed it does.
Mackey nodded toward his son.
Get off that chair and let the lady sit there. Pull the other one over here for yourself.
With the favoured son situated alongside his father, who had not offered an introduction to either man, John Mackey began.
I think you know who this is.
He pointed to the man who did not resemble his son, but who looked to be about Jim Mackey's age. He wore a suit of small houndstooth check, a crisp white shirt and black tie. His brown hair appeared to be going prematurely grey. Eleanor nodded. I do, yes.
But I bet you don't know his real name.
No, you're right, I don't.
Before we get to our friend there, by the way, it's Michael Kemp, only we like to call him Mick. Let me say a few things.
Of course. After all, you're a guest in my house. Mackey raised an eyebrow. The man who had pushed her into the room took a step forward, but Mackey wagged a finger at him. Eleanor did her best to temper her breathing. She was on thin ice again.
Miss White, I suppose I don't call you Captain any more. Anyway, Miss White, you have been a little thorn in my side. In fact, because you've drawn unwanted attention to my family, I have decided to abandon a business plan. A lovely idea that would have been very lucrative.
He shook his head.
And I hate having to do that, especially as in this case I hoped getting stuck into the job would bring my youngest boy back into the fold. Yes, yes, I should have known I was on a fool's errand, but a father has to make the effort.
It was probably a good decision, said Eleanor.
Shut your mouth and don't speak until he tells you to speak.
Eleanor could feel the thug brother's breath as he leaned closer.
Now then, you have also been keeping some sort of company with my sister, said Mackey. Lovely girl, our Elsie, but, you know, not exactly top draw. In any case, we always like to know a bit more about anyone who shows an interest in our family. I'm sure you get my point, Miss White. After all, it seems you understand secrets.
Eleanor said nothing, though she hoped that when the time came the man with the Luger was an expert shot, and the end would be quick.
Since the little, what shall we call it?
Mackey feigned thoughtfulness.
Yes, since the little intervention you staged yesterday, and by the way, we were all very impressed with your sleight of hand, I thought it would be a good idea to have this chat. So you can see that we're really on your side.
I'm sorry, I don't understand, said Eleanor. How could you possibly be on my side?
Mackey leaned forward. because you have absolutely no bleeding idea what you are tinkering with. If you're going to go into the hives, then you should do your homework and put on the right overalls and one of them silly hats so you don't get stung. And before you say another word, Miss White, and let's face it, you are a bit of an interrupter, aren't you? Let me tell you this, love. If you want to lift the lid off a hive, start with Scotland Yard. The second hive is the other intelligence service, the one what's not so irregular as your SOE. See, I know a lot more than you might have thought, thanks to our Mick over there. There's people, and one in particular, in Whitehall, who've got the sting that will finish you off if you keep poking around while they're about the business of making honey. But I can protect you from all that, if you leave us alone.
Eleanor frowned, feeling herself become light-headed.
Sam, get the lady a glass of water and be careful. I've heard she's a bit of a dab hand with glass.
It was clear Mackie was in no rush. He settled deeper into the chair. Michael Kemp had hardly moved. When a glass of water was in Eleanor's hands, Mackie continued.
Right. Now, we've got that out of the way. Let me tell you about Mick and how we know this young man. Remind me, what was his name when you knew him?
Eleanor cleared her throat. Blas. And he was supposed to have kept it quiet.
I'm sure he was, said John Mackey. But we're like family to Mick here. And what sort of name is Blas anyway?
He was assigned a Belgian name for his work, said Eleanor. I think you already know that.
No accounting for taste, is there? Anyway, young Mick is one of Jim's oldest mates. Always round our house he was as a nipper. Clever too. Well, anyone who can speak another language is clever in my book. I never did pick up much Italian from my dad. Mick's pop brought home a bride after the last war, which is why he can hold a conversation in Belgian and English, though I reckon the English is dodgy at times.
There was laughter among the men, a few words bandied around about Cockney rhyming slang.
Anyway, continued Mackie, Mick and our Jim got themselves into a bit of bother with the boys in blue. And as you know, they were sent down for it, and thanks to old Hitler, both of them were pulled out again to serve in the war. Jim learned what you might call a trade, and so did our Mick here. He learned a lot of things that have been very useful to us.
He smiled at Mick Kemp.
Mick, why don't you tell the lady about it? It's your story, after all.
Eleanor turned to the man she had last seen, clutching a headset to his ears in a small coastal village in Belgium some 3 years earlier. Yes, I think I'd like to know the story.
Miss White, I just want you to know one thing first. I couldn't tell you what was going on. It was more than I...
John Mackey interrupted him.
Mick, come on. Start at the beginning, son. Don't dive into the middle. And work both ways at once like my missus.
Kemp turned his attention back to Eleanor.
I was recruited to serve in Belgium because I can speak the language. They knew my background and they knew I wasn't squeaky clean, but as the boss said...
Which boss? Asked Eleanor, moving her head away from the Luger that was still too close to her ear.
The woman who interviewed me, who brought me in.
Eleanor sighed. Commander Claire Fields, was that her name?
Yes, that's her. Anyway, you know, I went through all the training, and then it turned out the radio lock was easy. I've always been interested in how things work, you know, electricity and anything with wires. They told me I was a natural.
You were? I'll give you that, said Eleanor. You were the best I'd worked with.
This is where it gets interesting, said John Mackey.
Eleanor's mind began racing ahead. Stephen Warren, we called him Luke, then you reported to him. What was he up to?
I'm nearly there, Miss White.
Go on, son, said Mackey. Take your time, and try not to let her hold you up every time she can't stop herself busting in.
Eleanor stared at Jim Mackey's father, a man who she knew could be brutal, yet appeared to be demonstrating an unexpected empathy. Kemp cleared his throat.
I was sending special messages for him, for Luke. Not to the usual place, but to another. Another unit.
He stared at Eleanor.
Look, I don't know exactly where they were, but it wasn't my usual partner. I think the messages went to another intelligence service. There was a different frequency.
Was there a code name mentioned, or a message recipient? Asked Eleanor. Kemp nodded.
Yes, it was Falcon. Luke told me it was all about how we had to limit risks because there was fresh intelligence coming through with new instructions. And you know, I was just the bloke with the radio.
Falcon?
Yes, Miss White. That was the code.
The brother standing close to Eleanor tapped her with the Luger. She turned, for the first time, taking account of the scarring on his face, the residue of wounds a skilled American surgeon could not erase.
Sorry, said Eleanor. Just tell the story, Mick.
Kemp fiddled with his tie, adjusting it and running his finger inside his collar.
Right. So, what happened was that where we were in that village, it wasn't the real landing place for our boys and the Canadians. We became the decoy because apparently the Germans had got wind of what was up, so the plans were changed at the last minute.
Eleanor bit her lip to stop herself blurting out a stream of questions. Kemp waited, then went on.
They had what they called casualty estimates, but there was also a plan to get you, me, and Warren out of there before the Germans really got stuck in. Our escape was to be by boat from along the coast. It looked like a fishing boat, but it was fast. We managed to get you over to it, then straight to the ship from there. It was all really bad.
There was silence in the room.
I'm just trying to get this all straight, said Eleanor.
Oh no, Miss White. It's a lot.
Eleanor saw tears well up in Kemp's eyes, but pressed him.
I just want to be clear. The plan, the original plan, was not the real plan, according to Luke.
That's the measure of it.
The real plan, the one that came from this other department in London, was the opposite. So the British and Canadian troops were actually landing along the coast, and the Germans were lining up at the back of us, behind all our people and the families living in the village. The Germans were there waiting for an influx of Allied troops, and were ready to render the village a battlefield. Is that right?
Yes.
We were the 11th hour stool pigeons, the decoy, call it what you will. The prey.
Yes.
Kemp seemed to choke on the word.
I was following orders, Miss White. Luke was my governor, after all. And we all had to trust one another, didn't we?
Eleanor looked up to the ceiling. She didn't want to meet Kemp's eyes, and she didn't want to look at John Mackey. She took another deep breath and brought her attention back to Kemp.
So the Germans began the attack? It's seared into my mind. I'll never forget it. A sniper was up in the tower. I had seen him right from the moment we went into the village. The sniper began firing.
Eleanor put her hand to her chest as her words faltered, her heart inflamed as a deep melancholy rose up again.
Then the child, the little girl, ran out because she had seen me from a window or something. You know, I'd given her lipsticks, and she remembered. She had somehow seen me in the square and ran toward me, and I killed her. I shot that child, and I killed her. I don't know what happened after I fainted, but...
Eleanor pressed her hands to her eyes.
Miss White, what are you talking about?
She looked up.
I killed that child,
You were there. I saw her on the ground. I wanted to go to her, and then...
Kemp's eyes were wide, his brow furrowed, as he shook his head.
No, 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 that's not what happened. It wasn't like that.
What do you mean? I saw it with my own eyes.
You didn't kill that little girl.
Was it the sniper?
No, he glanced toward Mackie.
Tell her, son, go on, tell her, don't hold back.
Luke, Warren, was telling you to take her down before she led them right to us. The sniper had an idea of where we were, but her running down the street was drawing attention. You wouldn't do it, and so you aimed for the sniper, but Warren grabbed your gun and he did it.
He wiped his eyes. He panicked, and he shot the little girl. You were in a terrible state when you saw her in the square, and because you were about to run out there to her, he pushed you down again, and you hit your head on the iron hub sticking out of the wheel on that old cart.
He took a deep breath. Horrible wound it was. Wide open and bleeding something horrible.
So I'm not surprised you don't remember it all.
But it stopped you running where the sniper would see you.
Eleanor felt a strange silence descend upon the room. Though she was aware of the everyday sounds, a tractor in the field beyond, a wood saw in the distance, and even a motor car passing on the road outside, she felt as if she were either ascending into heaven or descending into hell, and she wasn't sure which. Kemp's racking sobs returned her to the moment.
I didn't kill the little girl.
Eleanor could not speak above a whisper.
It wasn't me.
Kemp nodded.
But he, Major Warren, visited me in hospital. They sent me to a mental hospital because they said I needed psychiatric help.
We got you out of the village, Miss White, and you were bleeding badly from the head. Luke carried you all the way to the boat. It was all really terrible, terrifying. I didn't think we would ever get away.
I've not been so frightened in my life, and I never knew what happened to you after we went on board that ship.
I haven't seen Luke, Major Warren, since, and you were taken off somewhere. For all I knew, you were dead.
Weren't you debriefed?
You mean brought into a room and told it was all part of the plan, and it had to remain secret? That was the beginning and end of it, and then I was allowed to go home. Only I had no home to go to because the house had been bombed out and my mum and dad moved down to the country with my sister to stay with my aunt, and I wasn't well myself.
Kemp looked at John Mackey.
If you don't mind, Mr. Mackey, Miss White, I'm going to go out to your garden. I'll answer any more questions in a minute or two. I feel, you know, under the weather. Just need a bit of fresh air.
Eleanor said nothing. Her mind racing, memories surging forth, images clashing in her mind's eye, images that had never been quelled by the electric shocks to her brain.
Miss White, said John Mackey. Miss White, can you hear me?
Sorry, yes. Yes, go on.
Let me tell you what happened to Mick. He came home and couldn't settle. So I decided to help him out because I'm nobody's fool, and it was obvious to me that the lad hadn't been in the proper army. You had it rough, but so did he, and he had no one to help. My business isn't above board, but we don't deal in narcotics. We keep them off the street. Mick was starting to take pills, anything to stop the shaking and nightmares. I couldn't see him go down the drain, so I got him to tell me everything, and, you know, in my business, his sort of story is money in the bank, and...
That's how you've got DCI Warren and a government minister who went by the name Falcon under your thumb. You know the truth, and its terrible consequences, and you know Warren killed a child, which in wartime is a crime, even if it's not on the books. You use that information to carry on your business without consequences.
They're allowed a win every now and again, Miss White. After all, we like to be in a position to pull strings in high places, so we have to keep our stool pigeons nice and cosy.
Isn't Kemp in danger? They could kill him.
They could, but it wouldn't do them any good.
I don't understand.
I like to see a young man make something of himself, especially if he's a worker like our boys, and Mick Kemp is a worker. He's got a gift when it comes to anything with electrical sounds, that sort of thing, and you know I reckon it's the future, and a man like me has to think ahead. The BBC started that television thing again after the war, and even though they've stopped it because we've got a fuel crisis, Mick reckons that next year, what with the Olympics, it'll be a bumper year. People will go out and buy a television set on the Never Never, or a new radiogram or a wireless. So I set him up in a little business. Kemp's Television and Wireless. He's got his own shop in Peckham. Sales and repairs, and he's doing very well for himself. And more to the point, he's gotten in with an inventor friend at EMI, where they're fiddling around making this thing called a tape recorder.
A what?
It records voices, and it's called a reel-to-reel.
This is all very interesting, Mr. Mackie, but about Mick... Mackie shrugged.
Have it your way, but I thought you'd like to know that Mick put it all on tape. Or more to the point, Warren and the other bloke think he put it all on tape, so he's safe, because they reckon we have his voice telling the whole story. Personally, I'd rather he had it on a record, that's something I understand, but... We keep them playing our game because we know your detective friend was working both sides of the intelligence racket, which means they ignore what we're doing most of the time. Warren was a plant from one secret section to another because the Toff had him by the you-know-whats and probably told him it was all in the interests of the country.
Mackie tapped the side of his nose.
Amazing what you can find out when you sniff around where these upper-class types went to school, don't you think? Knowledge is a wonderful thing, Miss White. It's what built our business from the day my dad stepped off the boat after working his way across to England on a merchant ship.
Eleanor sat back and rubbed her head along the temple, hearing the whole story again as if she had one of those newfangled recorders in her mind. I wonder if Peregrine Gordon Williams was playing another side too.
Clever lady.
The Nazis.
To be fair, Miss White, I reckon some of them had to be what they call double agents. But there again, it's in the past now, and I don't care who they fraternised with, as long as I've got them under my thumb.
Mr. Mackie, why have you told me all this? It's surely not in your interests to let me in on what's going on in your line of work, though I... Eleanor held her hand to her chest and felt her voice catch. I don't know what to say to you because I've had to live believing I took the life of a child. Mackie nodded to the man who had been standing next to Eleanor since she had first been invited to take a seat in her own home. He turned to his other son, who had still not said a word.
Bobby, go and get Mick. He's still feeling a bit rough, and we should take him home.
He smiled at Eleanor.
Tell Jim he can come back to that half-derelict shoebox down the road they call a house. We don't need him. That's what this is about. We won't ever call on him again. My wife would like to see little Susie, but we won't push if he doesn't want to come.
I suppose I'm in your debt now, said Eleanor.
I suppose you are, but I'm not in the business of giving jobs to ladies who know how to use a gun. But keep that in mind all the same, about the debt. Nice that Elsie has a friend, though. She doesn't get out much.
Eleanor remained in the small drawing room as the men departed. The house was quiet again, still, the only sound coming from a pair of thrushes calling to each other in the tree outside. She stood up, went into the kitchen and opened a bottle of single malt whiskey. Pouring a good 2 fingers' worth into a glass, she drank the measure without pause and poured again, this time taking one sip at a time while standing at the sink and staring across the fields. John Mackie had not become some sort of criminal saint overnight, but he wanted her to tell his son that he was off the hook. He had shown a light on the truth, though only time would reveal if any account would be presented to her for being in receipt of such a revelation. After all, there might be some honour in the thief, but she knew there was little in the way of a soul, despite any appearances to the contrary. Eleanor sighed. In one way, her job was done. Jim, Rose, and Susie were safe now. But at the same time, another task had emerged, another account arising from Michael Kemp's story. She had questions about the proximity of the hospital ship, the sojourn in Oxford, her assessment and debriefing at that mansion in who knows where, another requisitioned stately home, this one very secret. Then there was yet another transfer. She remembered asking, "Where are you taking me now?" A man in uniform had leaned toward her.
"It's to a place where we can help you, Miss White. You've had a very nasty wound, so we're going to get you the best treatment for it. Make you feel better again. Lift the melancholia."
Lift the melancholia? The so-called lifting of her melancholia was a foul protocol that almost blew her brain out of her skull.
"It will eliminate the pain in your mind,"
the faceless, nameless doctors had said. So Eleanor had become a first-class patient, giving the right answers to questions and playing the game to get out, though she soon developed greater skill in poking pills into her cheek with her tongue and spitting them into the palm of her hand. She was released after a month, with the words of young Dr. Wright still fresh in her mind.
"Let time and nature do the work of healing."
Pressing a hand to her temple, she banished those memories from her mind as if taking photographs to a bonfire, until she was left with the one that would never fade. A child cut down by gunfire in a village square, her little white dress stained with blood, flapping in the breeze while her mother screamed, held back by her family. She remembered it all now. Eleanor White swallowed the remaining whiskey in one more gulp and poured herself yet another. Then she howled and threw the glass at the wall.
"You bastard, Warren! You lying, murdering bastard!